loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, a bill to renew the controversial Section 702 program, a key part of the mass surveillance state, has been introduced by the House Intelligence Committee. While members of the committee claim that the law would introduce new measures to safeguard Americans' privacy, the core spying powers of the NSA would be left intact. Then, in the latest assault on the alternative media, RT has had its congressional press credentials revoked. Meanwhile, the Mueller investigation moves forward as Jared Kushner is interviewed. We're going to talk about where things are with Russiagate. But first, we turn to Section 702 in the issue of mass surveillance. A bill to renew the controversial Section S-702 program, a key part of the mass surveillance state, has been introduced by the House Intelligence Committee. While members of the committee claim that the law would introduce new measures to safeguard Americans' privacy, the core spying powers of the NSA would be left intact. We are joined from Washington by Bruce Fein. He is a constitutional lawyer and a former Assistant Attorney General of the United States. And hopefully in a few minutes, we'll also be joined from Amsterdam by Bill Binney, a former NSA technical director who became a legendary whistleblower. Welcome back, Bruce Fein.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for joining us. Talk about what Section 702 is and what the current contemplated actions in the House actually will signify.
But let me begin, I think, with a more fundamental point for your audience, and that is, what's the use of intelligence at all? In our constitutional dispensation, the presumption is being in favor of liberty, that is, the right to be let alone from government snooping. And the burden is always on the government to explain why that sanctuary of privacy ought to be disturbed. And we don't have to give a justification for our liberty, our right to be let alone. That's inherent in being a human being. The burden is on the government as to why it needs encroachment. And typically in our constitutional system, that the burden the government has to show is that there's some probable cause to believe you're implicated and connected in some way to criminal activity. That's the Fourth Amendment standard. And what happens with gathering intelligence for foreign policy purposes, and that's enshrined in part in 702, is that probable cause standard, as being the demarcation line between your privacy and the government snooping, has been destroyed. And now, for foreign intelligence purposes, the government can go collect any evidence where there's an international communication that's involved, not based upon any cause whatsoever. It can vacuum clean everything. It can store it for as much as 5 years. It can search without any warrants to try to determine whether you could be implicated in crime or have some connection with foreign policy, international terrorism, or otherwise, and there are no outside judicial safeguards against the abuses. And even if they're not abuses, it's my judgment, your liberty has been encroached upon if the government seizes your conversation, just keeps it there without any justification suggesting you've done anything wrong. You have a right, if you want to live a private life, to tell the government, keep off, unless there's, say, probable cause to believe you're implicated in criminal activity. Now, what Section 702 is doing and has done for over 10 years now is it authorizes the government, without any cause whatsoever, to intercept the contents and the metadata of international communications between U.S. citizens and foreigners, among other things. And they can then store the communications that involve a U.S. citizen for up to 5 years, typically more because the storage can extend beyond that period as long as it said that it could be useful in interpreting at some future date foreign intelligence gathered by other means. And it's pretty easy to satisfy that standard. So we have just the staggering, huge haystack of data that we have to invent new words to describe the volume, beyond anything that the mathematicians could have conceived, years ago. And not only is it staggering in its potential impact on our privacy, which I think encourages a docile citizenry, everyone worried that the government could use that information, leak it out, deny them access to education or loans, or just take retribution against them. Even if it doesn't happen or happens seldomly, the threat itself induces docility. And that's, in my judgment, poison to a self-governing people. But there's another element, too, that's quite perverse, and that is the volume of information collected is so staggering that it basically becomes useless. There's not enough people to translate and understand and comprehend where this piece of information sits into a larger intelligence jigsaw puzzle to make use of it, which is why, despite the use of 702 for all these years, the staggering amount of data, there's no showing that's ever indicated that a single terrorist act has ever been foiled because of information so gathered. And you can, some people argue, well, this information is classified, and therefore they could have 1,000 success stories. They're all concealed, you know, in the chambers of the NSA. But anyone who's been in Washington knows that if there's a success story to be told, it'll leak out in half of a second or less. That's the way the bureaucracy works, and there have been no leaks of these so-called success stories. All of this, in the bottom line, means, in my judgment, there probably should not have any Section 0702 extended unless and until the government is able to show that it actually serves some purpose in detecting international terrorist crimes that couldn't be served otherwise. And that has not been forthcoming. At least a fallback position, and this is taken by some of the so-called opponents in the House and Senate, is at least if you're searching these staggering databases for criminal information about a U.S. citizen, you've got to have a judicial warrant based upon probable cause. And you've got to stop this current practice of intercepting the communications between Americans and someone abroad if it just mentions the name of someone like Osama bin Laden, who's on the terrorist list, even though the suspected terrorist is not a party to the conversation. That's purely gratuitous. That has no connection, I think, at all to the kind of interest that might justify encroaching on privacy. But that's kind of a long preface, if you will, to understanding what this debate is about.
No, it's very, very important. Bruce, we're joined now by Bill Binney, who's calling in from Amsterdam. Let me throw a question to him. Bill, Bruce Fein has made some very good and very important serious points about this program. There's no evidence that it's worked. And we only know about it because of the revelations that Ed Snowden made back in 2013. Can you tell us something more about this program? Has it worked in protecting Americans, or is this just an assault on our civil liberties?
Well, I mean, how many terrorist attacks have they actually stopped? I mean, General Alexander had a chance to testify to the supposed 54 that he claimed they stopped, and actually, when Senator Leahy said, okay, prove it, he actually proved zero.
Right. And it seems to me it would come out in court proceedings, too. If you've disrupted a terrorist attack, you're going to want to bring those would-be terrorists to justice. And at least something would come out in court proceedings. And as Bruce Fein said, nobody in Washington can keep a secret. The information's going to leak out anyway. And it hasn't.
And this whole thing is a charade anyway. They're really after all the data, not just the authorized by 702. I mean, through the muscular program, they took everything from those data service providers. And also from the upstream, they capture everything they possibly can that's passing across the network. So this is all just a charade.
Yeah, there's one other thing that I think is important, and that is, you know, the National Security Agency doing the surveillance, it's an arm of the military. You know, it's certainly contrary to what we might call the Posse Comitatus Act, which basically says we do not want the military involved in law enforcement. And that's exactly the claim. It's foreign intelligence. We know they search it for criminal justice purposes and use it in criminal cases. We have now the military. You know, that's ordinarily we call that martial law.
That's right. And in fact, NSA was not created by an act of Congress. It was just created with a stroke of a pen.
Harry Truman created it in 1952 in his secret memo out of thin air. And, you know, not only that, John, even as we speak today, there's no statutory foundation for the NSA.
And yet the NSA is perhaps really the hub, the center of all of this electronic intelligence gathering, sweeping up the intelligence, the data, the communications, the phone calls, the emails, not just of Americans, but perhaps every person on the planet Earth. Bill Binney, how did it amass such power just sort of quietly, secretly, in the dark? I mean, the puzzle palace, so to speak, came together without the American people even knowing about it.
In fact, they didn't really hear about it until the Church Committee investigation in the mid-70s. And then it came out that there was an NSA. And many members of the committee at the time didn't even know it existed. But in terms of capturing data and the ability to do that, that came over time with the lots of money being invested. And after 9/11, endless amounts of money and the technology and ability to leverage it and take advantage of it and capture all this information. So that's been possible since the 1990s. And they've been given the money by Congress to do it.
But I think I think those are excellent points Bill makes. I would add that when you go back and consider the times when the NSA was created in 1952, and you read some of these now declassified national security memos and discussions, at the time the Cold War was heating up, if you will, that's not an oxymoron, basically the idea was we have to go to the dark side. We have to be ruthless. We have to be as tyrannical and oppressive as the enemy if we're going to succeed. And those are the actual words used, I think, at NSC Memorandum 68 or something. And so at the time the NSA has created the idea that anything goes. You remember, this is the time where we're doing drug testing on CIA personnel who would jump out of windows. You know, we're overthrowing Mossadegh. We're overthrowing our Benz in Guatemala. We're doing all sorts of, you know, interfering with the elections in Italy. The whole idea at that time was, hell, you know, we'll not survive unless we become carbon copies of the enemy. But now we've retained it, and that's exactly what's happened. We resemble the enemy. So what's the difference between the two? Very little.
Bruce Fein, the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff of California, said earlier this week that he had proposed a compromise to this 702 reauthorization that he said would let intelligence agencies query a database of information on Americans without a warrant, but then would require a warrant to use the information in other cases, such as those involving serious violent crime. And here's the quote. He told reporters on Wednesday, "This would prevent law enforcement from simply using the database as a vehicle to go fishing, but at the same time, it would preserve the operational capabilities of the program." But that's not the point, is it? The point is that NSA is collecting the information in the first place.
That's exactly right. The Fourth Amendment prohibits the collection. That's the invasion of privacy happens when they collect the information. That's a search, right? A search and seizure is what's covered by the Fourth Amendment. When they seize your conversation, the violation occurs right then. What happens later may compound the violation, but it certainly doesn't exculpate it. And this is just another effort to violate the Fourth Amendment and the right to privacy, and maybe diminish it a little bit because they worry about keeping the current system may result in the whole shipwrecking of 702. But that doesn't, it goes back, I think, to the fundamental misunderstanding that as human beings, certainly as U.S. citizens, when we're born, we have an unalienable right to privacy and liberty, and it can never be disturbed unless the government makes a substantial case as to why you personally are implicated in some antisocial conduct. And that's the starting point. We've kind of lost the opposite. You know, the idea now is flipped. No, unless you got something wrong, why do you care whether the government spies on you? Well, if you want to volunteer to live in a fishbowl, that's your individual choice. But most people, if they want their privacy, they're entitled to keep it, and they don't need to give any other argument than they're a human being.
I want to ask Bill Binney about some of the language that goes with this, because the American people are always sold on the need for things like this based on some dire, pressing national security need to keep the country safe. If we go back to that original memorandum that created the National Security Agency, the National Security Council Report 68, which Bruce Fein mentioned, it was a blueprint for the militarization of the Cold War. I mean, that's really what it was. So we had a war. It was called the Cold War, and it was about containing communism. Then the Soviet Union collapsed, imploded, was overthrown, whatever you want to characterize what happened in 1991. And so then we had a new war that was necessary, again, to serve as a pretext for the maintenance of something that should have become a relic if it was designed to be part of the Cold War after the Cold War. And that explanation then became the war on terror. In other words, a convenient banner slogan. And then under conditions of war, people are always asked to sacrifice. You sacrifice your civil liberties and your civil rights because you're at war. And thus the war mantra becomes the sort of architecture, the propaganda architecture to allow the government to aggregate all of this power that's directed really not against an enemy per se, but against its own people. Go ahead, Bill.
And I would point out there's never been a war declared by Congress. So there really is no war. So all of that is not constitutional. They're taking over any rights and violating constitutional rights there's no foundation for it.
Yeah, World War II was the last war that Congress declared. Since then, it's all been aggregated power to take military action within the executive. Sometimes there's authorization, sometimes there's not, but you're right about that.
And I would also point out that what they've been doing all in secret, never letting anybody really look. Some of the legal justification for what they've been doing has been kept secret for so long, and even I don't even think we've seen it all yet. And so, letters from you in the OLC or Addington out of the Cheney's office or Gonzalez out of the president's office. Some of the interchange of legal documents, I don't think we have it all yet.
And just think about that, what Bill said. The last time I think we heard about the law being secret, because you're supposed to comply with it, is, go back to Caligula. He put the laws really high in tiny print on the walls in Rome so no one could see them and he could get away with all sorts of skullduggery. And the idea that you can have secret law in the United States that's shielded from public review, a country built on government by the consent of the governed, how can the people consent to a law they don't even know exists? How can Congress oversee a law? And basically that's what these legal memos are, just explaining what the law is. They don't even know it exists. I mean, that is so outrageous. And of course, it'd be one thing if we had these genius platonic guardians who never made errors, but we have situations like with John Yoo, his so-called law is then repudiated later on, but that's also secret. I mean, anybody who's involved in these issues know that they're tough, and you need outside scrutiny and cross-examination to come up with an answer that's reasonable. And when you have everybody just talking to themselves, and there's no real challenge outside because politically, my God, it could be leaked out. Everyone just echoes the party line. You have staggering errors made, like the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and they're all going to throw roses at us in Baghdad for the next 20 years. And so they get into these situations that prove the opposite of what they assumed because they never had a serious conversation and could be confronted and challenged by people who know things.
That's the voice of Bruce Fein. He is a constitutional lawyer and a former assistant attorney general of the United States. We're also joined from Amsterdam by Bill Binney, former NSA technical director who became a legendary whistleblower. John Kiriakou, I want to ask you and our guests about the role of Adam Schiff. Adam Schiff has been like a vanguard for the so-called Russiagate, without evidence, asserting that the intelligence agencies are proving beyond a shadow of a doubt, even though there's no actual evidence, that Russia influenced, meddled, hacked, whatever you want to say about the 2016 election. He's now the guardian of civil liberties and civil rights in the House, or that's the sort of position he's trying to take. He said earlier Wednesday, as we've talked about, that he has a proposed compromise, which is, yes, the NSA and the intelligence agencies can look at all of this data on the American people without a warrant. Again, that's the act, as Bruce Fein said, that's the act of violation of our constitutional rights, the Fourth Amendment. But only, as you mentioned, John, they could only be kept or continued if it related to a violent crime. I mean, Adam Schiff he's just a shill right now for the intelligence agencies.
Adam Schiff is another one of these neoliberal lemmings in the House of Representatives who does exactly what he's told to do by the intelligence committees. Adam Schiff is the ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, and as such, he is supposed to be one of the overseers of the intelligence community. In fact, he's not. He is a cheerleader for the intelligence community, just like Dianne Feinstein was on the Senate side until she rotated off. So here you have Adam Schiff, who professes to be a civil libertarian and a progressive Democrat, and he's just simply doing the intelligence community's bidding. He's not doing us a favor by offering this so-called compromise, the compromise still violates our civil liberties. It violates the civil liberties of every American man, woman, and child. There is literally nothing that you can say or do that the government is not going to know about. And in the end, they could use it against you without a warrant.
Bill Binney, jump in there, because I know we've talked to you in the past about the role of these Congress people and the role of congressional oversight committees. Is John Kiriakou right that they're just actually cheerleaders?
Yeah, I mean, that's changed over the years. I mean, originally, those committees were, and also the FISA court, were created after the Church Committee investigation in the 70s and the FISA law creation. So, but their charter was to look and watch at these intelligence agents, because NSA, FBI, and CIA were the ones looking at U.S. citizens under the Nixon administration, spying on U.S. citizens without a warrant in violation of our constitutional rights back then, too. And so out of that came the charters for these committees, who were basically formed up to ensure that the intelligence community did not spy on Americans. Well, now they're advocates for it. So, I mean, the whole thing is flipped. I mean, they've been useless for 10 to 20 years at least in terms of actually doing any oversight at all. I mean, the FISA court, even Judge Reggie Walton, after the Snowden material started coming out in August 2013, came out and said on the CNN interview that he had very little capacity to validate or verify what the NSA, CIA, and FBI are telling him. In fact, he doesn't have very little. He has absolutely none. The only thing he could do is say, cross this the T, dot that I, and fill out this form. That's all he can do.
Bruce Fein, Bill Binney's right. Reggie Walton said as much. The FISA court that he was in charge of wasn't actually a court. I mean, that's the essence of what he said.
Yeah, the reason is because ordinarily in a court you had adversaries. You have one party. Here, all you got one side of the case. I mean, this is like the French Revolution people's courts, where it was a crime for the defendant to offer a defense. So you don't have anybody but one side in there. And I can guarantee you, having clerked myself, the judges don't have, you know, capacity and staff there to run out to the CIA or NSA and oversee what they're exactly doing. They're totally dependent upon the trustworthiness of these intelligence agencies. And, you know, using intelligence and trustworthiness and intelligence agency, really, that's like bittersweet. They're opposites. And another thing that I think needs to be recognized, these intelligence committees, a huge portion of their staff comes from being detailed from CIA, FBI, NSA. So they got the fox, you know, searching overseeing the chicken house here. And that's, unfortunately, that's true not only the Intelligence Committee, but Armed Services Committee. All the military has their own people who serve as interns and get paid by the military, and yet they're in the key meetings that the Congress has, so they can report back to their overseers exactly what needs to be done to head off any kind of curtailment of what they want. So the idea of congressional oversight now is really turned into a complete joke. And Congress does not hire people, and they won't pay them well enough to have serious credentials and raise questions. And that's why basically you have the executive branch, they supervise themselves, which means no supervision at all.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, when I was at the CIA, it was up to the CIA to decide what to send to Congress and what not to send to Congress. I remember these long, drawn-out conversations. Well, should we tell Congress? Well, no, let's not tell Congress. We'll see how it plays out. So Bruce is right. That's exactly what it is. It's the fox guarding the hen house.
Yeah, and as we heard earlier, the intelligence agencies have a way, Bill Binney, of really making anyone who is their critic pay a heavy price. I mean, there's an overarching threat against, I would say, any elected official or anyone. You cross us, and guess what? We have a lot of ways to harm you. Go ahead, Bill Binney.
Yeah, that's basically what Senator Schumer said to President Trump. I mean, early on, he said if he doesn't watch out going after the intelligence community, they have many ways of getting back at him. So he should be careful, you know. Well, it's basically what he's saying is the intelligence community is a super J. Edgar Hoover. They have knowledge on everybody and information on everything. So if you have a weakness anywhere in your family or anyone you're associated with that you care about, then they know the weakness. They can use that against you, just like J. Edgar Hoover could. And the same was true with the Nazis or the Stasi or the KGB. They all did the same thing.
And I want to add, because to me, this is fundamental, is that these intelligence agencies are unable to forecast anything of significance. They never have. You can look at the history of all of the world, and there's never been a turning point that ever was based upon some new intelligence find. Even finding all the battlefield intelligence at Antietam didn't help General McClellan do anything, because the things that are that drive a country's success or failure are way beyond what intelligence community can possibly affect. And so we're spending all these tens of billions of dollars, maybe even over $100 billion now, on an enterprise that's a total failure. And they get graded like Montessori school students. They always get promoted. They never get anything cut. And there's no accountability. And so all of these great turns, whether it's in North Korea, or whether it's floating a new nuclear device in India, or whether it's overthrows of one country or another, the intelligence community always gets it wrong. You know, none of them got Robert Gates. You know, he gets to be CIA director for what? He predicted Gorbachev would be a big failure. You know, he'd go nowhere. And this guy, so somebody makes a staggering wrongful conclusion that has all sorts of adverse consequences, and he gets promoted to be the director of the CIA.
I think Gates, in his autobiography, also took personal credit for the collapse of the Soviet Union.
One of two autobiographies.
Let me add just one little point. You know, NSA and the CIA, they're not audited by anybody in the government, so they're given all this money to spend as they see fit just to do the job they're supposed to do, and there's no oversight or follow-up to make sure they do the job properly. So, you know, this is just a totally unaccountable. It's a setup for corruption, and that's exactly what we've got.
I think what Chuck Schumer actually did say when Trump was coming into office, or maybe had just come into office, and was disputing the so-called intelligence community's claim that the Russians had an influence in the outcome of the 2016 election. Schumer actually said these words: "It's really dumb," that's a quote, "to pick a fight," this is not a quote, "to pick a fight with intelligence officials." And then he said, and this is on national television, and these are the people who supposedly have oversight over these giant intelligence organizations. "Let me tell you, you take on the intelligence community, they have six ways from Sunday at getting back at you," said Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer. I mean, that's a message also to the American people. Don't challenge the NSA. Don't challenge the CIA. Don't challenge the FBI, because they're going to come at you. And this is the so-called leader of the legislative branch of government, or one of them.
And they will come at you. I asked a senator, a sitting U.S. senator, to write a letter of support for my application to President Obama for a presidential pardon. And he said to me, "As much as I would like to help you, it takes all of my energy just to try to get the CIA not to revoke my security clearance." And so there's this constant pressure on members of Congress to fall into line and to do as they're told by the CIA and NSA and other elements of the national security structure, the apparatus. I have another quick question for Bruce. Bruce, we've talked a lot about the House of Representatives here. There are more and more vocal civil libertarians in the United States Senate. Do you think there's any chance that this legislation will be further watered down to save Americans' civil liberties on the Senate side? We've got about a minute left.
Well, there's certainly a chance, and moreover, there's less control at the top on the Senate than on the House side, where everything is driven by Ryan on his own. And you do have Rand Paul, I think Mike Lee and others, who may be able to get, and Ron Wyden, who will be able to get some floor time to argue. And if the American people knew about this, I think they'd be violently opposed to it. I think that's why Ed Snowden evoked so much support. But I just want to, before we conclude, I want to just underscore how on the Congress, there's a speech or debate clause that makes it unconstitutional for the executive branch to be spying on legislators in the execution of their legislative functions, including oversight. And the NSA, they intercept conversations involving members of Congress and their duties, talking abroad or whatever. And the Congress does nothing. I mean, it's hard to imagine something more spineless, but that's dangerous, because it shows they're intimidated despite the constitutional protection.
Yeah, we're going to leave it there. They have six ways from Sunday at getting back at you. And of course, everyone in Congress, all 535 members, know that. They all know it. All right, we're going to leave it there. We've been joined from Washington by Bruce Fine. He is a constitutional lawyer and a former assistant attorney general of the United States. And we've been joined from Amsterdam by Bill Binney, former NSA technical director who became a legendary whistleblower. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World
from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
In the latest assault on alternative media, RT has had its congressional press credentials revoked. Meanwhile, the Mueller investigation moves forward as Jared Kushner is interviewed. We're joined from Iowa City by Paul Street, a journalist, historian, and author whose latest book is They Rule, the 1% versus Democracy. And we're joined from Baltimore by Kevin Zeis. He's the co-director of Popular Resistance. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
You bet.
Let's start with Paul Street. Paul, what do you make of these latest little bits of news coming out of the Mueller investigation? It seems like every time we see two steps forward in the press, we then see one step back. And in fact, there were a couple of pieces posted on various mainstream media websites today about developments in the Mueller investigation that were then taken offline. What should we make of that?
I'm not familiar with these particular pieces because I haven't reviewed the news today. But I think there's just this Trump is thinking, has been tweeting that this will be over very quickly. The whole Mueller investigation is going to go away, and it's not. It's sort of permanently entrenched for quite some time because the obsession with Russia is just entirely too useful to the power elite, and it's going to be here for a long time. It's just this incredible diversion from issues that really ought to be concerning us in this country right now, which is the fact that the top 10th of the upper 1% owns more wealth than the bottom 90%, that we have a police and a surveillance state that is crippling democracy in this country, that we live under conditions of an abject, thoroughly homegrown, domestic, homeland-based plutocracy, an open oligarchy in a nation that purports to be a great model of popular self-rule and is precisely the opposite and is no such thing. So I think we're going to be having this drama over Russia's alleged crushing of our democracy.
John Kiriakou, before we turn to Kevin Zeis, let me ask you, we had Mueller, according to the media reports, we don't know ourselves. We are not a fly on the wall, but the media is saying that Mueller interviewed Jared Kushner. Jared
right.
Kushner is cooperating. In other words, not having to be subpoenaed in order to be interviewed. What does it indicate to you?
You know, it indicates to me that Mueller is looking at a lot of these throwaway felonies that we've been talking about on this program for weeks. Things like making a false statement or conspiracy or perjury, things that don't specifically have anything to do with Russia. So if the leaks that we're hearing are to be believed, Kushner is talking about a meeting with former Russian Ambassador Kislyak that he attended along with Mike Flynn. So Ambassador Kislyak is not trying to swing the election. He's never been accused of trying to swing the election. What we have here is a failure to report the meeting to the FBI. That's one of these potential throwaway felonies. So I think at the end of the day, the analysis that I laid out on this show 2 months ago is going to be correct. We're going to see people charged with a whole bunch of different crimes, and none of them are going to have anything specifically to do with Russia.
And Kevin Zeis, help the audience then understand it, because the audience, meaning the general public, will look at headlines and say, Mueller, like today, the announcement was Mueller will make an announcement. So everybody had bated breath and everybody was on the edge of their chair. And this was the day after the meeting with Jared Kushner. The impression, and it's really an impression that the public gains, is, oh, Mueller is about to really, you know, the smoking gun is going to come out, or the indictments show that there must have been Russia collusion or Russia meddling. But what John Kiriakou is saying is that these are secondary charges or throwaway charges, not showing collusion with Russia at all, but one, getting people to flip on each other because they could be going to jail.
That's the bottom line.
They could be going to prison. And, you know, if you, you know, become a snitch, say what the prosecutor wants you to say, you know, maybe you'll get a lesser time. Maybe your son won't go to jail. That's the case perhaps with Michael Flynn. Anyway, Kevin Zeis, what do you make of it? You're an attorney. When you're looking at this and you've been following this for the past year, what do you expect from Mueller right now?
Well, I think Mueller's doing traditional
prosecutorial work. I think John is right that we're not going to see any charges focused on Russiagate, but that's a guess right now. We don't really know. And I do think we'll see charges on failing to file, not answering questions honestly, failure to tell the FBI when, you know, questions when they're asked. I mean, you know, all sorts of side charges that are felonies.
Yes.
And that can threaten people's, you know, a long time in jail. And I think Michael Flynn, of course, is the big story. Kushner, I think at this stage, from the reports at least, doesn't sound like he's cooperating in the sense of being a, you know, informant for Mueller. He's at this point, his lawyers are taking the approach, let's cooperate, give them the documents they want. Maybe they won't hassle us.
You know, and let's add also that Kushner's father went to prison with these, with some of these throwaway charges relating to his income tax, relating to real estate investments. And it was then U.S. Attorney Chris Christie that tripped up the elder Kushner. So I would have to think that Jared Kushner has spoken to his dad about this. And his dad said, listen, you should just cooperate because you don't want to go to prison, even if it's a minimum security work camp.
No. And prison is not a fun place, even if it's, if you're losing your liberty, not able to live your life, that's time you never get back. And so no one wants to go to prison. And Michael Flynn, I think, is the big story. Not only is he facing threats of prison, but his son is facing threats. I think that's the big leverage. And Michael Flynn, you know, there's only a couple of people above him that he could inform on that would help him stay out of jail. And that's Mike Pence and Donald Trump. So his testimony is the one that the Trump administration would be most worried about. And Trump has, as you know, tried to help Flynn in the past. You know, he said, oh, can you lighten up on Mike Flynn? You know, and so he's aware that Flynn has something to say, or it seems like he's aware that Flynn might have something to say and wants the pressure relieved. Well, the pressure was not relieved. In fact, the pressure is intensified. And now it looks like Flynn is starting to work out a deal to cooperate with Mueller.
And John, the charges against Flynn might be serious charges, because it's not only about a meeting with the Russians and not reporting it. He might be looking at kidnapping.
Charges. Yeah, I think that among all of the major players in this whole sad story, I think Flynn is looking at the most significant prison time, because there's this story that was broken last summer by the Wall Street Journal, of all outlets, in which it reported that Flynn had invited former CIA director and Navy Secretary Jim Woolsey to a meeting. Woolsey claims that he did not know the purpose of the meeting until he got there. He arrived 15 minutes late. This meeting was in Manhattan, and sat down and then realized that he was meeting with representatives of the Turkish National Intelligence Organization, the TINIO. He said, both to the FBI later and to the Wall Street Journal as the source, this was Woolsey. Woolsey said that the conversation was such that Flynn appeared to be offering to turn over Fethullah Gulen, a Turkish opposition leader who lives in a small town outside of Pittsburgh, if the Trump people won the election.
And Gulen is blamed by Erdogan, the president of Turkey, for all things, including the coup.
For all problems. Any problem the Turkish government has, it's Fethullah Gulen's fault.
If the garbage didn't get taken out.
Correct.
Gulen. Look to Gulen.
Exactly right. Everything is blamed on Gulen. As the details have come out subsequently, it seems that Flynn was offering up Gulen in exchange for $15 million. Which is an entirely different subject. That's called kidnapping.
And he was taking money from the company working for the Turks.
That's right. He was on the payroll of the Turkish government. So what we're talking about here is a class A felony. It's not making a false statement where you're going to get, you know, a 3-month minimum security camp or a 3-month suspended sentence. We're talking about the potential of 20 years in prison. And if you get more than 10, you're going to a real prison. You're going to a penitentiary. So I think that's what the negotiations are about right now. There's a secondary negotiation, at least as Flynn is concerned, where he's trying to save his son, right? What father wants his son to go to prison? And I think that negotiations are at a very serious stage here, where Flynn is going to try to save both himself and his son. And what's the only way to do that? It's to give up Trump.
Kevin, what do you think about that?
Well, I think the grand jury process is a very powerful tool, and the special counselor, Mueller, has a lot of flexibility. These kinds of investigations go on all different tangents, and You're looking at people who are testifying before Congress, who are talking to FBI agents. You have to file all sorts of documents. So finding mistakes and finding so-called crimes, these I like your term, John, throwaway felonies, finding these kinds of felonies is not surprising. Whether it leads to some kind of proof that Russiagate exists, that some way Russia is why Trump is in the White House, or that Trump owes a debt to Russia or something like that, we haven't seen that yet. They're not really fulfilling the initial obligation of the investigation, which is on Russiagate, but they are finding criminal activity and putting a lot of pressure on people around Trump.
Brian, Kevin Zeese raises a very important point here, and that's the issue of the grand jury. One thing that I think many Americans either forget or don't know is that Mueller's mandate is not to file charges solely based on collusion with Russia. His mandate is to essentially do whatever he wants, wherever this investigation leads him. If he finds out that you wrote a rubber check, he can charge you with writing a rubber check. What ends up happening is that he develops this information on a whole host of potential felonies, and then he can use those felonies as bargaining chips or as collateral. And he can say, all right, I've got 5 felonies on you, 10 felonies on you. I will dismiss all of those felonies but one if you take a guilty plea and you testify against the next guy up the food chain. Well, it's Manafort and Flynn so far who are at the very top of that food chain. And presumably, Donald Trump is the ultimate top of the food chain. So I think we're still relatively early on in the process.
Very early.
We know that there are several other sealed indictments. We don't know who they are. But Flynn has a literally unlimited budget. He has some of the... Mueller has a literally unlimited budget.
Flynn's budget is becoming more and more limited.
Flynn's budget is in serious trouble. He's got some of the best legal minds in the country available to him. People who have vast prosecutorial backgrounds and experience. And he has all the time in the world.
And you said, and you're right. I think a really key point you made there is that this is very early. 8 months he's into this. He's already got a conviction and indictments. And he knows that we already know that Flynn is on the, and maybe his son on the verge of indictment too. So he's really going pretty fast. But the average age of these kinds of special counsels is 2 years. And for Bill Clinton, they lasted two of them lasted 6 and 8 years. So we are early in this process. And so you could see Trump for the rest of his first term being under investigation and indictments coming as the next election is approaching.
Let's turn to another part of Russiagate, because this ongoing witch hunt is impacting, of course, the individuals who are involved in the investigation or touched by the investigation. But it's also, of course, impacting Russian-owned media. That would include RT. In particular, the RT was forced by the Department of Justice to submit to register as foreign agents under the FARA Act, which was passed in 1938 to stop Nazi propaganda in America. I mean, I consider this to be a huge, huge outrage, and it's clearly directed. It's selective. It's directed against Russia, against RT, not because RT is functioning as a mouthpiece for the Kremlin. It has a whole variety of voices. I'm on that station a lot. John Kiriakou, you've been on that station. People from the left, people from the libertarian movement, people, you know, it's got, in fact, as alternative media goes, it has a wide variety of different views.
Oh, it really does.
On it. And yet, as part of this smear campaign against anything Russia or Russian, RT was required to, you know, go along and sign up as a foreign agent. They were also told that it wouldn't obstruct or inhibit their ability to do what they do, which is function as an alternative media and as a news source here in Washington, D.C., the nation's capital. But now the news comes that the U.S. Congress, as a consequence of its registering, RT's registering as a foreign agent, has withdrawn RT journalist accreditation on Capitol Hill, again, citing the company's, quote, foreign agent status. This is a disgusting attack on alternative media. And I'm sad to say that so many people who are liberals, who, of course, like me, are opponents of Donald Trump, are also going along with the Russia conspiracy theory, including taking away the press credentials of RT, which many of these same people have watched or used as an important alternative media source for a long time. It's disgusting.
And may I add something to that before we ask for Kevin's response? In the letter sent by the Executive Committee of the Congressional Radio and Television Correspondents Galleries, telling RT that their credentials had been revoked, they say very specifically, this action was taken in response to the registration of RT Network's operating company registering as a foreign agent. The rules of the gallery state clearly that news credentials may not be issued to any applicant employed by any foreign government or representative thereof. So I'd like to know why the BBC has press credentials on Capitol Hill. Is the BBC not fully and wholly owned by the government of the United Kingdom?
No, I think that there's a long list of BBC-like networks that from Asia, Latin America, around the world that are covering Congress and have credentials to cover Congress. This is obviously targeted at Russia. I think RT's gotten caught up in two very strong forces. One is Russiagate, and the whole neo-McCarthyism that we're going through around that whole nonsense. And the other is the whole fake news thing, and which is really a cover for an attack on independent media. Now, corporate media, the mass corporate media, the CNNs of the world, the Fox of the world, they're all struggling with their viewership. They're having a hard time getting as many viewers as they used to get. And what we're seeing as they're going down is an upswing in alternative media outlets that include foreign journalists, that include independent journalists, that include activist journalists, social media. And so there's a whole other source of information. A study just came out of Harvard about a couple weeks ago that showed that when alternative media work together, they have a very big impact on people's thinking. They have a lot of power, and they're afraid of that power.
I think you're right. And we don't really have alternative media working together in this country. And there's a lot of really great alternative media, too. And I'll tell you, Kevin Zeese, when I was in prison, there was a gentleman in Southern California, just outside of Los Angeles, who every week would print the articles that you wrote and articles that appeared in Popular Resistance and send them to me in prison. And that's where I got my news. It was from outlets like Popular Resistance. Totally serious.
Isn't that great? I'm glad to hear that. Now, we're always impressed when we hear those kinds of stories that, you don't realize the impact you're having. And we're about to upgrade all of our media stuff. We'll be announcing all that soon. But, there's such a desire for real news because we are seeing, people are seeing through the mass corporate media. They're seeing through the New York Times cheerleading us into wars. They're seeing through the corporate spin that we get on all the cable outlets and network television stations. People want real news. They don't trust. And that's another interesting thing. Surveys of trustworthiness of news. The traditional news media is so low. And the social media, independent media is on the rise. And RT was very credible. RT did not. I've been on RT again, a show, a network, and I'll go on again. I'm not going to be bullied by this Russiagate fear. We need to stand up and say no to that. And I'm really disappointed not to see more media groups in the United States responding to this taking away of their credentials. Now, in some ways, I got to tell you, for my own independent media activism, the credentials are somewhat of a burden. They have all sorts of rules up there on what you can cover on the media in Capitol Hill. So, for example, if there's a protest inside of a congressional office, the media is not allowed to go in to cover it. Of course, when we're not credentialed, we've never been credentialed. We do all sorts of we'll do a live feed from the inside the office.
Well, maybe it's liberating to not be credentialed.
They can take it that way. I think I think RT has to think about how they tactically respond to this. You could have an oligarch buy RT and they're no longer controlled by the Russian government, or you could actually see this as a benefit and just go in as send the activist type media in. And film like we all do in the hallways and violate the rules, go to committee meetings, mm-hmm. capture the focus on the protest. There's a lot to cover up there. You know, you can really get a lot of news up there too, because they, if you know, there have been traditional journalists. Izzy Stone is one great example, who would just go to congressional hearings, listen, and write critically. So there's a lot of power in that, and he, you know, Archie can still do that. Now, I'm not saying they should be have their credentials taken away at all, but they got to find ways to still operate and be as very. They can be an even stronger news source even without those credentials.
I think you're exactly right. You know, it's funny too. You see so many reporters on Capitol Hill, if you're in the House chamber, the Senate chamber, and they're just sitting there in the press gallery. Literally, they're just sitting there. And maybe every once in a while, one of them will get up and walk downstairs to an ante room just off the floor of either one of the chambers and ask a member of the Senate or the House for a quote. In my mind, that's not really journalism necessarily. At the very least, it's not investigative journalism. I think you make a very important point. And something that ought to be energizing to young journalists, and especially to young journalists involved in alternative media, to not be credentialed, to go to those committee hearings, to walk the halls, and to cover the stories that are frankly more interesting and more important.
And capture those senators and members of Congress in the hallway.
That's right, because they're going to be in the hallway.
A surprise question that they're not at a press conference where they're prepared for, but catch them in the hallway. And also develop relations with all these nonprofits and advocacy groups that are up there all the time, report on what they're doing. There's so much not reported that's going on in Capitol. They can really help to put a face on the movements of people on almost every issue, who are up there criticizing the two parties. There's a lot that could be done, and I hope Archie doesn't back away from this, but uses it as a way to try a new approach and figure out a way to actually be a stronger media outlet.
I want to talk about I agree with all those points. I want to talk about the sort of poisonous atmosphere, though, that the mass media is creating. Now, the leading force here in Washington, D.C., and this gets picked up all around the country from local papers, is, of course, The Washington Post. If you read The Washington Post editorials, the ones directed by the editorial board, I'm not talking about the reporters here, I'm talking about the editorial board, they have gone full throttle against RT and against Russian media and against Russia, and have asserted over and over and over again, without documents, I mean, without proof, hard evidence, that Russia, in fact, impacted the outcome of the 2016 election, and that, in fact, Russia had a concerted effort to do just that. Now, you know, we know about James O'Keefe and the Project Veritas, an organization that, you know, I'm just say for the record, I find loathsome. I think it's creating all sorts of trickster journalism, trying to, you know, set people up, sting people, create edited videos. But there is one thing that's come out as a consequence of a recent Project Veritas video, which is quite interesting. They went to a bar, apparently. I think it was a bar where Washington Post reporters hang out. And they talked to someone named Adam Enthaus. Now, they didn't announce that they were Project Veritas, but they filmed this. And they're asking him about their coverage on Russiagate. And this is what Adam Enthaus says. And he's the Washington Post national security reporter. Quote, and this is on the tape, "Our reporter has not taken us to a place where I would be able to say with any confidence that the result of it is going to be that the president being guilty of being in cahoots with the Russian. There's no evidence of that I've seen so far." And then another part of the tape, this same national security reporter says, "Frankly, there may not be anything that gets the president. It may just be low-level people who are compromised by this. We don't know. It's very hard to tell. So we just don't know at this point." Now, if that reporter is in fact telling the truth, that we just don't know and that nothing may come out of it, you would never get that sense from reading the Washington Post editorial board, which speaks with absolute authority and confidence that this is an accomplished fact. So is it a situation, Kevin, where the Washington Post reporters, many of whom may be doing good work, honest reporters, of course, constrained by the fact that they are employees and that they can be fired if they don't toe the line, they're saying one thing, at least in private, we don't know where this is going, where the editorial board, for political purposes, has said absolutely Russia did all of the things that we're saying that they did. Is that possible?
Oh, no question it's possible. I think you're being very generous to the Post. I mean, what that reporter said in private, he would never report in an article, not talking editorial, in an article reporting on Russiagate, he would never write that. You know, and he probably can't write that. As you said, they are constrained. And some of our best reporters who left New York Times and other corporate media outlets, as well as the Washington Post, you know, are now independent and writing independently and much more veracity. Project Veritas takes the name Veritas. It's almost like what Congress did. You know, they name something the opposite of what it really is. Well, Veritas is the opposite of what it really is. It's really Project Falsehood. They take things out of context, et cetera. And their videos now are being used in that horrible J-20 case around the inauguration protest.
The judge allowed those to be shown to the jury, which is terrible.
Yeah, really. I don't think that those tapes said much, I gotta say. I recall when they came out, at least. They weren't all that impressive, and that whole case is not impressive. I don't want to get up on a tangent on it, but, you know, they had very low-level proof conspiracy, and there was damage done, and they're all guilty of the conspiracy. So it's a really difficult defense, but it's a tough case.
Again, going back to Enthouse, Adam Enthouse, he's a guy who's been, John, he's been really following the story. So he doesn't know he's being filmed. And again, I don't approve of Project Veritas at all, but the Post isn't asserting that this thing on tape isn't true.
Right.
And he says, because he's done all the real reporting on Russiagate, in terms of actual secret arrangements where they cooperate, we haven't seen anything that shows that yet. We've seen a lot of flirtation, if you will, between them. This is presumably between the Trump camp and Russia or Russians. Flirtation, if you will, between them. But nothing that, in my opinion, would rank as actual collusion. Now, that doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. It just means we haven't found it yet. Or it may mean it doesn't exist. Now, those are his actual repertorial words based on his coverage, based on his investigations.
And then at the same time, you have Washington Post readers reading that editorial page and seeing the company line that Fred Hyatt is putting out there as the editorial page editor. And it's at odds with what we're hearing from Washington Post reporters. Let me tell you another thing. I am an avid listener of AM radio. I know you don't love AM radio, Brian.
I used to.
But I like AM radio, at least having it on in the background. I was listening to a program day before yesterday in which somebody called in and said, I think Trump is guilty. The host said, guilty of what? Guilty of all this Russia stuff. He ought to be prosecuted. Okay, prosecuted for what? All this Russia stuff. Well, that's the thing, is the press, the mainstream media in this country has whipped people up into a frenzy, and yep, they're not even sure what they're angry about.
Yeah, that's it. It's like a witch hunt. We've been joined from Baltimore by Kevin Zeese. He is the co-director of Popular Resistance. You can read Kevin's writings at popularresistance.org. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.